And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Hello and welcome back to all of you. And hello to new viewers, listeners, whatever you want to call yourselves. Comrades in the struggle, it's good to have all of you here with us today. And for those people in Canada, formerly the Dominion of Canada, who are listening in, get ready not to vote next week. October 21st is when you can say no to the act of treason called voting in Canada, because it doesn't matter what party you vote for, people, every single one of them takes an oath of allegiance, not to the voters at all, not to even a thing called a constitution, but to a foreign monarch, to one person, Queen Elizabeth and her descendants. That makes anyone who's a member of parliament somebody who's involved in an act of treason. So you can say no to that. What's interesting, though, is that even though a lot of people agree with us, they still keep voting. And we consider this a habitual act, but it's also a sign of being in a state of possession. Our minds tell us one thing, but our bodies won't do it. Our lives won't change. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about that today, and we're going to actually share with you a roundtable discussion we had on that and other issues last month. But it's especially appropriate this week because 10 years ago last Friday, I stood outside the Vatican and I performed an exorcism, a calling out of the entity of that place. It was very interesting because after doing that, the next morning there was a tornado in Rome, first one in 40 years, and that same week the European media began first reporting the evidence of the direct ties between Pope Benedict, Joseph Ratzinger, and the cover-up of not just child abuse and trafficking, but child killing in Europe and beyond. So it's interesting what those acts do when you stand in that power and you call out the institution to its face. The power that works through us is quite interesting. I always found the analogy quite telling, you know, the story when Jesus goes into the temple, wipes out the money changers. Very interesting story, because he did that right next to the Antonian fortress where the entire 10th Roman legion, 6,000 heavily armed Roman soldiers were, yet he goes in, according to the narrative, he does that, he walks out unscathed when he's standing in that power of the universe. And yet the next day he gets arrested because he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane and he relies on the people around him and he's betrayed. So to me that's always an interesting lesson to all of us, that when we stand in the power of the universe, whatever you want to call that, when we stand in the truth, we are protected. When we tend to rely on the people around us who aren't in that condition, we get the knife in the back. And that, time and again, has been our experience. It doesn't make us discouraged. It makes us understanding where our real power lies. Now, when we're dealing with this enemy, you know, I get the impression more over the years that we're not dealing with the appearances, the institutions, that we're almost dealing with a single mind. And the different manifestations of this are the different individual brain cells. We are the different brain cells, if you like, of this group mind. And some people call it God, some call it the overmind, the collective unconscious. Marcus Aurelius called it the hegemonicon, the hegemonic mind that influences all of us, the way things seem to be. What's interesting is that some of us aren't in that mind. Some of us stand outside it. Maybe we're born that way, whatever. And when we invoke that power, then things start happening way beyond our means. And I'm aware of that right now because this campaign for the Republic in Canada or anywhere, the campaign to bring down the Vatican, stop child killing, it's such a dichotomy because these forces that we're up against seem huge, and yet we have moved them. Just a few dozen of us have moved the Vatican, the government of Canada, over the genocide, and that's because that power is working through us. So I want to remind folks about that. There has to be that personal awakening and allowing that power to work through us before the political change can happen. We have to seek that source within us and around us, that power, not rely on the people around us or the ways of the world. And I'm especially worried about that now as we're heading into this next week. So a reminder of this event 10 years ago and also what we're heading into. For those new listeners, you can follow our work, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates. And write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com. I've been on the campaign trail working with people. Despite our paucity of funds and support, we're still making headway because when an idea has come, it has a disproportionate power. And I had an example of that recently. A friend of mine who was campaigning got stopped by the Mounties. And the Mounties recognized the name and said, "Oh, you're with that Republic, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, good luck." And that was coming from a Mountie, a sworn agent of the so-called Crown, the fictitious entity that we like to think is the head of state. So it's about taking back our power, folks. That's going to be the theme of today's show. We're going to be sharing with you a roundtable discussion we did in Toronto that touches on this and many other issues. And so learn from it, act on it, write to us, get involved. The power is within you. You are the Republic. You are the new society. Here's our show. Thank you. Stay strong. We'll see you next week. And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. It's September 8th. Yeah, we made it this far, people, and we're going to make it further. We are here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, in the territory of Kanata, the reclaimed territory. That was Billy Bragg and Amanda Palmer singing "The World Turned Upside Down" about the Diggers Movement in England in 1649, the same year they chopped off monarchy's head and established a republic for 11 years. We're going to hear about that in some detail today. We're going to discussion about the legacy of that and our need and our movement to reestablish self-governance, a self-governing republic in Canada and around the world. And as part of that, we're going to be playing an interview that a number of us did together, kind of a joint interview in Toronto on August 24th, but it provides very essential background information for people who need to know about the campaign. What is our vision for Kanata, Republic of Kanata? How are we building it on the ground through the People's Assemblies? What is our basis of authority? We're going to talk about all that today in this 30 minutes from an extensive series of interviews that you'll hear. And you can find at murderbydecree.com and go to ITCCS Updates. You'll see all our latest posts. And if you go there today, you'll see something that was just put up. It's actually called a campaign news update for Sunday, September 8th, 2019. That's today. And in it, I'm going to do kind of a little summary of some of the stuff because it's very important information. And I'll be back after our broadcast today to give some more updates before we sign off. But if you go there, you'll see, and I urge you all to read this newsletter, especially all of you in the West and in Ontario especially, where there's going to be upcoming meetings for the Republic during September and October. You'll notice the first posting in this newsletter, the campaign newsletter, is, "Where oh where is Justin Trudeau? An elusive prime minister hides in plain sight. Rulers caught with their pants down tend to avoid the spotlight. Sometimes, like in the case of Pope Benedict, they hide out altogether. Well, Justin Mini-Me Trudeau is no exception. Ever since being publicly named and summoned as a major defendant in Canada's latest war crimes tribunal, Trudeau has dodged the media like a besieged Richard Nixon in his final days. On September 6th, the Liberal Party announced that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will not participate in upcoming party election debates, including the televised Maclean City TV debate set for September 12th. With the Liberals dropping in the polls as the federal election looms on October 21st, the party is doing its best to fog and downplay two political bombshells: Trudeau's personal involvement in the SNC Levin-Lamb bribery scandal involving his own cabinet members, and, thanks to our work, the growing evidence of his ties to Aboriginal-killing Chinese corporations operating all over northern British Columbia. Trudeau refused to respond to a public summons issued to him last June to answer questions about these ties to the Chinese that'll be aired at an upcoming tribunal starting September 16th in Vancouver. Well, perhaps not unrelated to all of this was an interesting phone call made on September 2nd to a journalist named Sarah Webster, who's writing a series of articles for us about the Republic and yours truly, Kevin Annett. And she got a call from a lawyer who claimed to represent the Prime Minister's office, or the PMO. The lawyer grilled Sarah Webster about an article she's writing about me and the Republican movement. According to Ms. Webster, quote, "The lawyer asked me why I had contacted the PMO and whether I'd done so on behalf of Kevin Annett. When I told him no, that I was simply researching an article about him and wanted to interview someone at the PMO, he pressed me for information about Kevin's location and plans. When I played dumb, he warned me that my failure to disclose information involving the security of key government officials constituted a felony and I could be prosecuted." "Well, what does Reverend Annett have to do with the security of government officials?" I asked the lawyer. When he didn't reply, I continued, "Are you saying Kevin Annett is a threat to their security?" "I've been so informed, yes." "Informed by who?" "By the relevant authorities." "Do you mean a political threat?" "I'm not free to comment about anything else." Well, Clearly, Justin Trudeau and those around him are more than a bit nervous about the Republican campaign spotlighting of the Chinese connection to the Liberal government. Attacking the messenger, in this case, once again, yours truly, well, that's his standard ops for criminally complicit regimes of both church and state. In a way, folks, it's like trying to close the barn door after all the horses are loose, as we used to say in Winnipeg. Now, other news. On the campaign trail, we have two new delegates to a future Republican Congress who are now campaigning with us, with me, Tim Barch in East York, Toronto, and Brent Everall in Picton, Ontario. The new delegates announced their identity and their work this coming week. We'll have more on that in the week. They live on the west coast of Canada in Alberta. One of them is a Native woman who's actually declared sovereignty in her community and said that they are working now with the Republican movement to establish a Republic of Equal Nations in Canada. These new volunteers are joined by many others now across the country. It's interesting because the survey done 4 years ago in Canada showed that 58% of Canadians want a republic. Well, our straw poll down on the ground in the course of our work and my campaigning all over the country now, we got a figure of 73%, folks. It's climbing. The disgust with this corrupt crown-based system is growing every day, and I see it on the ground every day. So that is probably why we've got three new Republican assemblies that have been formed and chartered this past week. That brings a total to 11 across Canada. And don't forget, these Republican assemblies can be formed by 12 or more people in a community. You sign a charter, constitute yourselves as a legislative assembly with the power to form a citizens' militia and local common law courts. Those assemblies can then issue citizenship identity cards and deputize local police to disavow their allegiance to the Crown and serve under the authority of the Republic. Well, all that you can get by writing to republicofcanada@gmail.com. Also, of important announcement, September 22nd, the Republic is sponsoring a National Day of Action against genocidal Canadian churches. Those 60,000 murdered children were part of the fuel that ignited the Republic of Canada. These churches that killed all those children in residential schools have no legal or moral right to operate. Ever since they've been convicted as genocidal institutions in February 2013 in Brussels. There's a standing arrest warrant against the top officers of the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches. These churches have been legally evicted from our territories, and their property and assets can be lawfully seized by the people. Well, on Sunday, September 22nd, we're starting that process again. We'll be picketing, occupying, and reclaiming these churches across the nation. So please get involved in this. Don't forget, this is not a one-day event. This ongoing disestablishment of these churches and the reclaiming of their space is part of the program of the Republic to cleanse our nation of the ongoing genocide in Canada and the institutions responsible. And finally, the Free University has announced, we're going to have a discussion of this next week, 5 blacklisted scholars gathered in Vancouver to form what's called a Free University, to be a platform for scholars who have been blacklisted and fired for their exposure of genocide in Canada, something I personally experienced at the University of British Columbia, and also to decorporatize the university to provide a more relevant community-based, decolonized educational system. So that's exciting. We're going to have more news on that. And if you go to, all of this is described in that posting, the latest posting, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates. You can find it there. You can also see in that section on the newsletter talking about the Free University. Scroll down and you'll see copies of leaflets and an email internet notices that were sent out by the Free University this week to the faculty and the students and staff at Vancouver Island University in Nanaimo and University of British Columbia in Vancouver, describing how their campus sites are repository of mass graves of Native women and children, and how these universities are being complicit in the ongoing genocide of Native people. So those are the main announcements on that notice, and I really urge all of you to go to that. Write to us, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, @gmail.com, and get involved. There's the upcoming meetings in Toronto, Picton, and Owen Sound, especially during the week. They're on September 16th in Owen Sound, September 18th in Toronto, September 20th in Picton, and we will be doing boots-on-the-ground activity during that time. We have a big chunk of our support in Ontario, but this is all over. Those of you listening in small communities, you're not alone. We can form support and bring support to you, but you've got to get on board and go beyond support that's 73% of your supporter public, to taking out citizenship and getting involved. This is going to happen only through our own efforts. So with that, we'll go to this kind of a roundtable discussion we had in Toronto on August 24th, and we'll hear two clips from that, and then I'll be back after these broadcasts. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back. We're here with Kevin Annett. And with Tim, and for Anne-Marie, and we're going to continue on with our discussion about the Republic of Kanata and our plans for the 2019 election. So we're going to turn it over to Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's something that a lot of people know instinctively, a lot of Canadians, that we're tired of being ruled from overseas, which has been going on for centuries from the very beginning. First the French, then the British, then the Americans, now the Chinese. I mean, the point is that at the bottom of all of this, you've got a colonial system still in power.
Is it still colonial, or is it more to do with money now?
Both. It's always colonialism has always been about money, of course.
Well, it's been more about power too, and like a nation power, right?
Well, you keep the colonies dependent and sucking all the wealth into the mother country, right?
Right.
Here's how Canada is still a colony. Its official head of state is a governor general who can remove the government at any time. He's the Queen's representative.
Right.
80% of laws passed in Canada are never even debated in Parliament. They're passed what's called order in council, which is the Privy Council. It's a bunch of insiders who get together and say, hey, let's have this law and put it in. The police do not lay criminal charges in many provinces. I think they do in Ontario, but in BC and many others, they don't. The Attorney General does. That is, the party in power gets to say, well, you can lay off this person. Oh, bring criminal charges against this person because he's our political enemy. That system is all old British Empire, old boys network of how you operate.
I have a question about that. So in the old Attorney General page, it said that the Attorney General at the time was the Queen's representative.
Governor General.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Did you say Attorney General or Governor General?
Originally, it's the Governor General we're talking about.
Right.
The head of state in Canada.
Right. Yeah. So, and then it also said that she was representing the country of Canada, which was also a de facto government. So they're telling you it's a de facto government.
Well, de facto means it exists as a fact, but it's not de jure, which means under law.
Right.
Because under law, here's what happened. In 1649, there was a revolution in England, a civil war started by King Charles I, waged against his own people using foreign mercenaries, plotting to overthrow Parliament. So he was brought to trial by a court set up by Parliament and tried, found guilty, legally, and executed. At that point, there were two laws brought in, banishing monarchy forever from England and making it a crime for anyone to try to reinstitute monarchy.
Interesting.
11 years later in 1660, his son, Charles II, had a military coup where he reimposed the crown of England against the will of Parliament and the people. So ever since 1660, the British crown has been a de facto illegal power. It reinstituted itself by force, not according to the will of the people, which is the ultimate source of law. Even the kings were admitting that. So that means that there's never been a legal basis for the crown authority in Canada. It's a de facto rogue power operating in court. You know, Rupert's Land out west, 1670, right at the same time. His cousin, Prince Rupert, was given all of Western Canada by Charles II. Okay. And then somebody else's land, like what popes did all over the world, just gave all this land to this royal idiot, Prince Rupert. He then sells it to what became the Hudson's Bay Company, right? And so Hudson's Bay Company then owns all of Western Canada, and everybody has to start dealing with them. It's been one huge land grab from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in other words, we've been operating under crime and fraud from the very beginning, and it's time for people. We tried this in 1837, tried in a revolution right here in Toronto, William Lyon Mackenzie. And I'm proud to say my great-great-great-grandfather, Philip Annett, took part in the attempted insurrection to overthrow the crown. It got defeated. And after that, that's why we had genocide in Canada, because after that, the power of the crown and the churches were they were made absolute. You in Quebec, it was the Catholic Church. Here, it was the Anglican Church. You couldn't, if you were a Christian minister in any other denomination, you couldn't legally operate. It was a total dictatorship. And on that basis, they set up the first Indian schools where the church were given absolute power to do anything they wanted, including kill 60,000 children eventually. So empire, genocide, it's all being part of the same thing. Now, if we want to say no to all of that, it's got to be we, the people who do it.
Right.
58% of Canadians want that to all end. They want a republic. We're acting on that mandate. Nobody else in no political party in Canada is daring to talk about this because they all take an oath of allegiance to that foreign monarch, criminally convicted monarch in London.
And it makes a big difference too about like how people are educated and what they think is the law.
Yeah.
Right. Legalese and the laws of Canada are actually the laws of a certain society. It's not actually common law, the law of the people. So police are enforcing policies of a corporation.
Right.
And that those policies are obviously in favor of the corporation. Mm-hmm. So people are being sort of like run through the mill in that, where they're not actually getting justice for a tort.
No.
Go on.
I'm sorry. I didn't
mean No, that's fine. I mean,
well, in anybody, if you want to jump in, in courts, anyone who's been to a court knows what a farce it is. Because everything is in the hands of your lawyer.
Right.
Which is a mistake. Do not ever get a lawyer because you cannot have somebody else represent you. Right. Any more than you can have a member of parliament represent you. Right.
Can you represent yourself?
Absolutely.
Though? But in like what capacity? Like if you go to the courts, right, and you have your capitalized name, who are you representing?
The capitalized name is not you.
Right.
It's a corporation that was created in your name when you were registered at birth. And so the government deals with the corporate identity of you. They don't deal with flesh and blood.
Right. Naha. So how are you able to represent yourself? Are you, because according to them, you're only there to represent right. a corporation.
You stand outside their corporate designation. You say, and people have done this in court quite often. You don't enter because the court is set up like the bow of a ship, because it's under right. admiralty law where the captain has absolute authority. So
right.
the little gate is like the entryway to the
right.
bridge of the ship, right? So you stand outside the gate and you say, Your Honor, or whatever you want to call him, I am here. Let's say you've been summoned into court. You say, this summons was addressed to a capitalized name. Are you referring to me, the natural person, or the corporate entity created my name at birth?
Right.
Okay. And at that point, the judge usually will either try to intimidate you, or they will very rarely admit that that they're referring to a corporation, because then you don't have to answer. So, well, then you go talk to the corporation. I'm going to leave. Right.
Right.
That's the reality. But they want you to confuse the two in your mind. Mm-hmm. Once you separate the two, you can stand outside their legal system and their political system, because I never gave consent to any of this.
Right.
And without my consent, I don't have to participate in it. As long as I'm not harming anyone. And who am I harming by not participating? Right.
Right. That's good to know.
Yeah.
So I was born in Australia. So my name on my birth certificate, again, is in capital letters. So Australia is part of the British Commonwealth. Is that why? Like, is this, you're saying Canada is a corporation, so Australia must be too, right?
As part of the Commonwealth. But that capital letter isn't just in the British Commonwealth. It's anywhere where the Roman Empire had their foot, which was almost everywhere in the world, because that was a designation from Roman law. It's called Capitis Diminutia Maxima, which means in Latin the maximum diminishing of head, which head meant like
authority,
standing,
government.
You're standing in society. So if you're a slave, you're all capitalized letters, because you were property and owned by somebody else. You had no natural rights. You could be killed. You had nothing. That's your designation under the law. You have no rights except what they give you. In other words, anyone who lives in the society according to their official ID is a slave.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot refuse anything you're told to do as long as you become part of that. If you step out of it, you're free. But even the word name, N-A-M-E, it's from a Hebrew word meaning the plaque you hang on the neck of a slave showing who owns them. That was the nomos.
Wow.
So your name is your slave designation. It says who owns you.
Right.
And notice in the Bible, God says, I am who I am. I have no name.
Right, right.
Free. And that's us. Each one of us is a soul that has no name.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You notice a cop will stop you or a judge, and the first thing they ask you is what?
What's your name?
What's your name?
Yeah, right.
That's they're out making an offer to you. We're offering a contract here where you step into our system and tell us what your slave name is. Then we own you. You're confirming, yes, I'm in your jurisdiction.
Right.
But say, don't answer at all. They're stopped. They can't do anything if you don't offer your name. Or if you say, I am who I am.
Right.
They're powerless at that point because you haven't stepped into their jurisdiction.
Wow.
Their little arena, right?
I remember that.
Is the average policeman aware of that?
No, because they're trained in statute and they just think, oh, well, they got to identify who they are. Otherwise, they're trying to hide something.
So
it's an assumption of guilt. It's an assumption.
Right. So that's the thing. So if you do that and then the cops think that you're rebelling, then doesn't that start like some sort of situation that you probably don't want to be?
Is rebelling an offense? Show me the statute where to rebel is an offense. I mean, by rebel, we mean not cooperate.
Right.
Why should not cooperating create a crisis? And it shows you how tenuous their system is. If you not cooperating with it, sends them into an immediate panic.
Right.
Why would
absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it works.
Always works. Unless they want to get rough with you and throw in a jail cell, then you charge them with assault and battery and all that.
Has that happened
earlier
to you?
This year, right?
That happened, yeah. I've been detained illegally, but I just kind of laugh your way through it. And it's designed to intimidate.
Right.
If they, you know, it's like when somebody says, I'm going to sue you. Well, if you're going to sue me, you'll do it. You won't warn me.
Right.
If you're going to kill me, you'll do it. You won't send me a death threat in the mail, right? So usually 99% of their power is fictitious. It's based on your fear of what they might do to you.
Right.
And as soon as you step outside that fear,
I'm not going to play this game anymore.
They have no power over you. And if you multiply that by even 10 people, there were a dozen of us in Vancouver who occupied that Catholic church that triggered the apology about the residential schools.
Right.
Because you strike, like Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, you strike at what an enemy loves and you negate their overwhelming power.
Yes.
They may outweigh you in numbers, but they have to respond if you're hitting what
a nerve system. Yeah.
Right, which is what you do.
Okay, so how are you going to set up the assemblies?
We are going to, we've got a model of work where you go in and 10 people sign a charter, 12 people, I'm sorry. And it says that we are constituting ourselves as a lawful assembly to debate and make laws and enforce laws in our community. And we have the right to elect our own police force, our own common law courts. And those are the three components, really, of government. An assembly.
A legislation. And then an enforcement.
Courts and an enforcement arm.
Right.
So police or militia, common law courts, and a common law assembly. And you, that's the basis of your new society. And that's what we try to create all over. Eventually, those local movements will have to link up into a national congress of some kind, right? But again, these are delegates, the people running for the Republic of Canada now, Republican Party of Canada. We aren't standing as candidates to be elected to Parliament because Parliament is a treasonous body. It takes its oaths, its allegiance to a foreign power. And we're delegates to a future Congress, right? We are representing our own selves and asking for people's help in bringing this republic about. So we're kind of like tip of the spear right now that hopefully many people will hold eventually. Right?
Shakespeare. Okay, so And what are you doing, like, locally? And where are you going to be? And who are the other representatives? Where can people get in touch with groups? Or are you going to have an online presence?
That's about five questions.
I know.
Well, we can all talk about that. Yeah. I'm campaigning all over the country. I was raised in North Winnipeg, so that's where I'm officially running out of. And so, you know, Tim is in East York, and Brenda Averill is a candidate in Picton, Ontario. We have two in Alberta, one in British Columbia, who are probably going to announce this week their candidacy too. One of them is Native, Algonquin. So it's really at this point raising the flag.
Okay, I like that.
And
raising the standard.
Right. And potentially there's a huge base for this because the level of corruption now is so extreme. The people are just so dissatisfied everywhere I go about this stuff. One example is the degree of child abduction going on in the system, the degree of the corruption in the courts.
Oh, 100%.
Police brutality at every level. Just, you know, it's like a society that's rapidly become a police state. Mm. And yet in Canada, people don't like to see themselves like that. So we don't say it. But it's, I think, obvious to anyone who goes up at the system in any way, you see the fraud that operates at every level and how it's backed up by all the so-called authorities, you know. So I think I'm not saying anything people don't already know themselves, but we're taking it to another level now, saying you do not have to live under the status quo. We've got to educate ourselves about our real nature and our real power and take it back, reclaim it.
So how about, what has your audience been mostly? Like, who are the people that come out and support you?
Totally unpredictable from all over. You know, it's like this work about genocide in Canada over the last 25 years. All the people I expected to help weren't there. But the ones who were there tended to be people who had been shafted themselves in some way, who knew what I was talking about from their own experience. It's the same way here. It's usually, I find the best support is in small towns, rural or small town communities, because there are people, I think, have kept, you don't have the disorienting effect of the big city, mm-hmm. where people feel there's no base, there's no roots anywhere that are possible in this concrete jungle. The small towns and villages, people have a sense of that, no, I know the mayor, I know the cop, you have a sense that we can already do that. In America, they have the county sheriff system, and that's what we need in Canada. Where people elect the local police. You don't have the Mounties come in who are a paramilitary force under their own laws. You need locally elected common law sheriffs, right? And when you have locally elected sheriffs, I know in America, our parallel movement there, when they do common law workshops, first people they invite are the sheriffs because you're accountable to us. You right. have to know the common law.
Right.
You're not a statute enforcer and a revenue collector for the government, which is what right. cops are, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's the power. We have to appeal. If the police won't get on board with us, we create our own common law police force. That's the whole idea.
Okay. I hate to be a Debbie Downer here. But so you're talking about elected sheriffs. Well, in any system where you're electing people, a lot of fraud enters that type of
it can.
System.
It right. can, depending on the
pay
the people
off
involved.
To elect me, right?
Well, you have to, it's like with anything. It's like with judges or the government. How do you know it's not going to be as corrupt? That's the reason people don't get involved with something new because, oh, it's just going to, you know, the old cliche, it's just going to replicate the old society again, right? Say hello to the new boss, same as the old boss, right? Yeah. And historically, that's often borne out. But that only happens because the people have lost a sense of their own virtue and their own... This society we live in encourages greed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't allow you to do the good thing because you're treated like a sap, like a naive person. It encourages atomized existence. So naturally, people are going to be corrupted by that. But really what we're part of is a spiritual awakening. I found it really interesting that in America, before the American Revolution, there was a thing that called the Great Awakening. It happened in the 1730s and 40s. And it was this evangelical movement mm-hmm. Manifested by the appearance
Alexander.
Of a lot of Baptists and like This was a grassroots movement all over America of a spiritual awakening, saying people felt the millennium was coming, and they, to receive Christ again, they had to be pure souls. They had to live justly and rightly in relation to each other. They couldn't have bishops over them. This led directly to the American Revolution. They said, no bishop, no king.
Right.
That was Charles, before Charles first got his head cut off. He said, you can't do away with the bishops, then you'll do away with the king next. Well, exactly. That's what we want. No hierarchy in our spiritual life or in our political life. We, the people, can govern both our churches and the republic. That's really how America came about. So it was preceded by this spiritual sense among people that, yeah, we're masters of our own destiny. And once you get that on a personal and spiritual level, the politics follow.
Absolutely.
And you get revolutions happening. So in Canada, we need, alongside, we're talking a lot about politics and law and all this, but at a more basic personal level, we need that recovery of hope, which I knew growing up in the 60s and 70s, people had more of that back then. We felt we could change the world. And after the 80s and the nuclear war scare and just the despair of the last few decades, I think we've lost that, a lot of us. And
well, you know,
we have to recover it.
I think that when you have the majority of, like, the next generation going to a school system that tells them that they're products of evolution and actually quite disposable, then they don't grow up with self-worth nor the ability to self-determine or self-govern.
Well,
I was just going to say, too, I think that generation was co-opted by consumerism.
Right, right, very much. And that's the evil thing now. And we live in this completely materialistic, meaningless society. You know, suicide now in the world is the third highest cause of death.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's because when you lose meaning and purpose, what is there to live for?
Yeah,
exactly.
If you're, and we're all raised to be functional components in a big corporate machine. Well, what they're forgetting about that, the so-called rulers, are if you do that to people long enough, you're going to lose your reason for existence, and the whole thing is going to
fall out.
Yeah, but
maybe they didn't forget that because they that's what they want in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, but it can't sustain itself. It's unsustainable, you know, at a human level.
But that's what I'm saying. They don't want humans to sustain themselves.
Well, it's ultimately a question of what we do, not what they do. Like what we are realizing, and, you know, you see this in classic cases. The poorest place I ever visited was a Guatemalan refugee camp in southern Mexico. And these people had nothing. They were starving to death, literally. The food that was brought in fed the 5,000 of them. Every week, about 50 kids would die of malnutrition. They're just running around totally destitute. They were the happiest people because all they did was live for each other.
Mm-hmm.
They worked and they struggled. And one of the translators said to me, our leaders are the poorest ones among us because every day they just work for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't think about themselves. Mm-hmm. And the ones who were thinking about themselves have left long ago. They
right.
just took off for America or whatever. But that's that spirit we got to recover in ourselves, that when we're working for each other and the higher purpose and find that meaning again, it gets us through poverty and depression, all of this stuff. And I found that there was a really good book I read years ago, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. He was an Auschwitz survivor. And he started the school of psychology called logotherapy, where he said that the basic drive in human beings is not towards power, not towards sex, like Freud would say, right? It's towards meaning, the search for meaning.
And but logo is like words.
Logos.
So
logos
means God.
Consciousness, really, in Greek.
Oh,
it means thought. But he said the people who survived the death camp, who survived, didn't get better food. Their spirit was different. They had one of three things, or maybe all three. They were living for, they had a great love in their life, somebody they were remembering, holding on to. They had a cause. They were sometimes in the underground movement. They had a cause to live for. Or they had a creative project. They were an artist. They were a writer. They were a poet. And those three things, the common denominator is, it was something outside themselves. It was higher than themselves. It was something they could live for. And that's what we lack in society. We're, this is atomized nightmare. And I find when people get excited about these kinds of movements, it's because, hey, there's a higher purpose in my life now. I remember a Native woman once told me that when we were picketing one of the churches down here. she came, she said, Kevin, you don't know what this has done for me just being out here. I've found my purpose now. I found that I can do something more than just worry about my addictions all day, right? And what happened to me when I was a kid. And we got to give that to people. We got to show them that that potential is in all of us. We just have to tap into it and we can change the world. We've shown that in practice.
You know? What were the three components again? Love?
Love, a creative project, a cause to live for. And I find, you know, that's what sustained me too. I mean, it's.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? Like, you've done wonders, really, and you're able to, like, continue on despite all the slander and the trolling. And
it's because I'm not losing sense of not only those three, but me, because I didn't find out who I really was till everything had been stripped away.
Right.
And that's often where we find it, our nature, because there's that part they can't take from us, no matter what they do to us.
Do you think, I think it did with you, but you can tell us, your belief in God entered into that?
Well, if that's God in that sense, yes, absolutely. It's entrenched it even more, that awareness of that ultimacy in me. You know, Jesus wasn't kidding when he said the kingdom of heaven is within us. He never talked about it being in a communion wafer or in a church.
Right.
He didn't talk about any of that.
Totally.
He said, this is where it begins and ends.
And right again, it is right. I am that I am.
Yeah, right? Same thing. Oh, yeah. So all of the paraphernalia falls away, right? All of the pretense and all that. But what we're left with is we know what we have to do now. What's at stake now? Our backs are to the wall in the society, right? The lives of our children, the health of our planet. Mm-hmm. We have to unite to save our planet, to defend our rights, to defend our children. We all of our divisions have to be overcome to unite around those three basic things: our liberties, our children, our future, the Mother Earth. I mean, that's got to be our program, right? And that's why
what about the fight for human rights? Is that, you think that's like, I think it's like, you know how we talk about words, right? So in the Bible, God created man. He didn't create human, which can be a color of man. Is that just me looking into it too much?
It's about, no, you can always look into things. It's words are really important because they have power. Like when you spell a word, it's a spell you're casting, right?
Right, of course.
Okay, so freedom, take that word freedom. And it comes from a German word, Freiheit, which was the rights granted. If you were a tenant farmer living on a big estate, the landlord would grant you certain rights. Oh, you could use the water, you could do this, but limited rights, restricted. So a freedom is actually a restricted right given to you by a ruler.
Right.
Liberty, libertas, means no restriction. If that's our natural state. There are no restrictions. There are no barriers. We're governed by reason and compassion. Why do we need law? We do the right thing. We don't need religion. We don't need law. We don't need rulers over us. We will govern ourselves and help each other.
Right.
Love your enemy, or love God and love your neighbor as yourself.
Right. Two and laws. The law is written in your heart.
It's written in your heart. And you just have to access that and then things will be fine.
Right.
But we're told all the time, no, you got to do this. You can't do this, da, 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 because you're not competent. You're not we're brainwashed. It's recovering that inner liberty.
So the reason I'm asking that is because there's like, you know, there's a whole push for human rights right now. And I mean, a lot of things are manipulated where you think you're doing the right thing, but actually it's not the right thing, right? It's their version sort of inverted and converted into something their policies, right?
Give an example. Yeah.
Well, like you even said, well, like even about freedom and like, If we have these rights, then why are we fighting for these rights? And what rights are we fighting for?
Depends which ones you're talking about. And
right. I mean, I can't really think of an example right now. I just see that there's, it's kind of like buzzword, right? So what makes this different from what the establishment is already doing with developing, you know, social justice warriors that are all fighting for their rights?
Okay, well, here's the
thing.
What's
the difference?
Okay, rights in our culture is it's one person fighting against somebody else. It's an adversarial-based system.
Okay.
That's really commercial law. A law exists to have competing property owners vie with each other, right?
Right.
You know, the old saying, the law is a good thing for a man with property and a very bad thing for a man without property.
Right. That's very good.
I remember my first year in law school, I took a year of law and then I had to drop out, but I couldn't stand the atmosphere. Wow. But I learned a lot. But I remember a legal process prof got up the first day of class, and the first thing he said was, all the law students were poised with their pens, right? He said, it's not against the law for a poor man to sleep under a bridge. Think about that. And they're all going, oh, we got to think here? Like what? And then he looked beyond, like the law just exists to reinforce the status quo, which helps the rich over the poor by and large. And so what do you do for the majority of humanity who doesn't have access to any of this, right? You got to create a system where there is no adversarial system anymore. You go back to the natural law. People naturally share. You know, we don't naturally have authority over each other. Maybe it's temporary, but you have to give consent to that and you can withdraw it at any time. I mean, it's just all common sense. Mm-hmm. And that's what the common law is common sense. And it's very basic. And so rights, fighting for different rights, it's usually one faction fighting for another. And the only way to get around that is to say, what's the common ground here, people? What unites us? And you never hear people talking about that these days. What is it that unites us? I mean, you know, there's more genetic variation in one troop of chimpanzees than there is in the entire human race. We are that close genetically.
Amazing.
And that means we are really, I mean, we talk about the one soul, right?
Yeah.
The one, we know this intuitively that we're made for cooperation with each other, not adversarialism. Mm-hmm. People naturally want to help. Look what happens whenever there's any kind of disaster. Boom, people are in there helping, right? They're yeah, yearning to help each other all the time. Mm-hmm. Yet where do we get the opportunity in this kind of sick society? Like we're always encouraged to fight each other or be indifferent or be afraid of each other. It's like, I'm sick of it. You know, I'm sick of it.
It's true. I mean, that's why we're here, all of us, right?
Yeah.
Because we're all kind of on that same path. I definitely believe in cooperation versus any sort of competitiveness. I think that, you know, all those things, even competitiveness is good in its own context. But I think that we are really, we are actually, it's better for us to work for somebody else than it is for us to work for ourselves, to acquire like a better result. And actually that goes back to like some of the, what the bleep do we know as well. It's like when you work for yourself to like say attain something, you have your own blocks about where it is. But if someone goes to do something for you, they don't have blocks that you have.
The power of numbers, right? And I find the best person to compete with is yourself, because I think mm-hmm. the way I've changed over a lifetime.
Totally.
And it's a constant. I mean, I, you know, the old saying is you've got so many things within yourself to overcome. Who are you to talk about another, right?
Right.
So maybe that's what Jesus meant by not judging, lest you be judged. But we can judge and should judge, but starting first with ourselves. And once you do that, you get a really humble view of humanity. I don't mean false humility, but you identify with people, you know? Like when I lost my children, and I didn't see them every day in this church-funded custody battle, it stripped me of my family. Sunday nights after I dropped off my kids, I was devastated emotionally. You know how I dealt with it? I'd get on the bus in Vancouver, just ride around and be with people. Doesn't matter who they were. It just fed off the energy of other people, just being with them and looking at them and watching them laugh. And it sustained me. I didn't go off, shoot up with something. I didn't.
That's good.
I realized my strength was there in humanity, right?
Right.
And people picked up on that, and that's, you know, and with anything, that's, we've got to draw strength from each other.
I admire your extraordinary bravery to set, because you could be pretty easily snuffed out, and not a lot of people would be inquiring about it. right?
Probably not.
So, well, you sort of just answered the question in that you said if you have a firm conviction about something and it's the truth, it kind of what keeps you going. But really, like, what keeps you going? In light of the fact that you're vilified and you're blacklisted and people say terrible things and you're constantly getting bad news about this is being shut down and that, you know, and then, I don't know how you do it.
When I was 31, the short answer is, I don't know either. Like, I just know it's the right thing to do, and I'm pissed off what they've done to my family, what they did to me and my children, what they stole from me, for no reason other than I was talking about their dirty laundry, which they eventually had to admit themselves, right? Where the hell did they get away doing that? And all those kids on the ground, and patting themselves on the back because they said the right words now. I mean, it's partly that. But I remember, this is very deja vu, when I was 31, I was in seminary, I went on a fact-finding tour to the Guatemalan refugee camps on the border of Guatemala and Mexico. These are people who are refugees from the Civil War there. Horrible stuff. And I was taken into the camp by a guy called Brother Fidel. He was an ex-Catholic priest who had been booted out by the bishop because he was getting too close to the Indians. Kind of like deja vu for me, right? And too much like Jesus, right? Kind of according to the Bible too much. But anyway, so he was living among these refugees, right? And the Guatemalan army kept raiding across the border and killing people all the time. And kids were dying every day from malnutrition, typhus, dysentery, the whole bit. Rickets, kids running around blind, you know, nightmare. But these people were the happiest, those children and those people. They had a love I'd never seen before anywhere. And when I came back to Canada, I felt it was barren. I felt like I'd come back to a dead zone because I didn't find people who were devoted to each other. They would die for each other. And they did all the time because they had nothing else. They didn't have the buffers. They only had each other. And I remember I said to Fidel one night, I said, which means faithful, I said, don't you ever get scared like what you're asking me now, right? And that was on the other side of the veil I had to go through myself, that when you go through a testing, you say, hey, I did it. I'm stronger than I realize. I'm braver than I realize. We all go through that. You know, when we've been through, we discover that warrior in ourselves, right? Nobody can do it for you. You've got to find it on your own. But I said to him, don't you get scared? And he said, yeah. And he said, I got in my Land Rover and drove away once from the refugee camp. And then I came back and I said, so what brought you back? He said, well, whenever I get scared, I go to the poorest child in the camp, and I just look at her, and I realize she can't get away. And she gives me the courage to last another day. And that's my friends who died, okay? That's Harry Wilson. These people were all killed by, he was killed by the Vancouver police, beaten. Bingo Dawson, these people are all part of our movement in Vancouver. They're all targeted after we started occupying churches. They're all just killed. Ricky saw that he ended up dead. William Coombs, you know this one. William was the one who saw Queen Elizabeth take those kids. Erica Kelly, the nurse who treated him, said it was arsenic poisoning. We've got that testimony from her. She's going to testify at the tribunal as well in September. All the classic symptoms of arsenic poisoning. He dies suddenly. He's about to come to London to give testimony. He's called in. The Mounties bring him to St. Paul's Hospital, Catholic Hospital, and he's dead in 48 hours. So these are my brothers, sisters, right? They keep me going every day. So does Maisie, right? Because you find out you're bigger than yourself, right? I mean, exactly. It's for all of them, for all of us. And we find that among ourselves. And I just want to, before I get to you, another beautiful story about William. They used to hold him at the Kamloops and Mission Catholic schools. They had him on a rack at night, like a rack. And the priest would sodomize him with a cattle prod, right? Because he was a spirit dancer.
And they would target the traditionalists, the ones with the sacred knowledge. And they would destroy them. That was the whole point. So they really targeted William. And he couldn't even go near a Catholic church. He couldn't hear the sound of a church bell. He'd start getting sick, right? So we go into Holy Rosary Cathedral one morning. There's about 50 of us. I'm the only white guy there. We show up. And normally the cops and the Knights of Columbus are surrounding the church to keep us out, right? Nobody there that morning. And the doors are standing wide open. So I say to everybody, you know, this is a sign. We've got to go. So we walk in to the cathedral during the mass. And we got our banner. All the children need a proper burial, right? And we stand at the front of the cathedral. And everyone is just gobsmacked. They don't know what to do, right? The people in the pews are kind of interested, right? And the priest is freaking out. He gets the organist to keep playing to drown us out, right? And people are kind of wondering what's going on. And the priest is getting, he's turning red. He's just so hate-filled, right? And he comes over to me, and he actually gets me in an arm lock, this priest. And he said, we're asking you to leave. And I said, we've asked you where you buried the children you killed. And he goes, "Phah!" And he walks off. He just leaves, right? And so we're just standing there with a banner, and the people are just don't know what to do. And I'm looking out, and there in the pews is William. He's got these flyers, and he's handing them out to people with this big smile on his face. I said, "Holy shit." Like, William, and the elders start drumming. They kind of sense when the cops were coming, so we walk out. And as we walk out, everybody stands up. That Catholic population there, you know, they all stand up. Just, they knew the right thing to do, right? So we get out there, and everyone's so happy, right? And the cop comes running up, lumbering up, and he said, "You can't go in there." I said, "Well, I already did. Sorry, you should get here quicker next time," right? And I said, by the way, read this, and I gave him a leaflet, right? So I go over to William, man, and we're hugging, and I say, "William, what gives? Like, how did you do that?" And he said, I saw you going in, and I didn't want to let you down." Right? And I realized then, the way we all heal, we do it together. You know, you don't do, he went to counseling for 20 years, didn't do a thing for him. That one day, and he'd stopped drinking that week. It came back, it only lasted a couple of weeks, but he stopped drinking. And that's, if you knew William, what a miracle that was. But it was a miracle only as complex as the fact that we did it together. He said, "I don't have to be afraid of those priests anymore." I went out and just see they're just people. And like the institutional mask falls away and we just see they're just people, right? And so if you ask me how I get the courage, that's part of it. But there's an unknown part that I can't explain. And I think it's finding who we really are. You know, I've had more things open up for me inside since then as a result that have answered that more for me about why I have that ability I never knew I had. But you find it. And you go through, my worst pain was losing my daughters, right? That's why I got accepted in the healing circle. They saw I was suffering and bleeding. I wasn't the do-gooder coming to fix them, right? I was just their equal in our pain. But we weren't afraid to talk about the pain. And that's hard in Canada to do that, you know? Oh, yeah.
And we're back. William's words is what I want to leave you with. I didn't want to let you guys down. I did not want to let you guys down. Let's not let each other down. Let's stand by each other over the time ahead, not with words only, but with our bodies, what we do with them every day, where our hearts and minds are. We have to overcome these false divisions, the false conflicts and animosities created between ourselves and that we create among ourselves. Put it aside. Our backs are to the wall, people. Now's the time to unite. republicofcanada@gmail.com, murderbydecree.com. We'll be back live next week with more updates. Follow the updates at ITCCS updates under murderbydecree.com. Stay strong, stay clear. You are the Republic. I thank you.